What can one do against Satan's wiles? On leaving the world, I found myself surrounded by monstrous beings which dragged me with them in a veritable whirlwind. At first I implored the protection of the celestial archangels, but the hellish spirits kept me prisoner. However, I never lost hope of being rescued at any moment, because I had left some money to have monthly masses celebrated for my eternal rest. Yielding to my pernicious habit of meddling into matters which were none of my business, I insisted, "How interesting your observations are. Didn't you try to find out the reason you were kept so long in those regions?" "Absolutely not," she replied, crossing herself again. "As I have already told you, I did my best to be good and pious while on earth. But you know that nobody is completely free from sin. As a rich woman, I might have led a peaceful life if it hadn't been for my slaves. They were always full of mischief and kept quarreling. Of course, punishment was often necessary. I had to be firm in giving my orders, always scrupulously carried out by my overseers. It wasn't rare for a Negro to die at the whipping post as a warning to others. Sometimes, to avoid trouble, I was obliged to sell slave mothers, separating them from their children. I felt the sting of my conscience on those occasions, but every month when Father Amancius visited the plantation I went to confession. After having received an absolution in the confessional, I was free from all those venial sins and again in peace with God and the world in general. Shocked at these words, I began to reason with her, "But sister, that kind of peace is false. The Slavs are also our brothers, and to the Almighty Father, their children are just as good as their masters." She stamped her foot angrily in protest, "God forbid. That could never be. Slaves are slaves, or the church would teach us otherwise. If there were Slavs at the bishop's house, why shouldn't there be on our plantation? Who would work the land if not the Negroes? Believe me, it was an honor for them to live in my Slav quarters. On my plantation, Negroes never came to the guests' courtyard except to carry out my orders. Father Amancius, our virtuous priest, once told me at confession that Africans are the worst creatures in the world, born exclusively to serve God in bondage. Do you imagine, then, that I would have scruples in dealing with them? You can be sure that slaves are wicked beings, the devil's own children. I sometimes admire my own patience in tolerating them on earth. Let me tell you, I passed over most unexpectedly from shock over the princess decree abolishing slavery 9. Just imagine, setting those scoundrels free. It all happened many years ago, but I can still remember it perfectly. I had been feeling poorly for a few days, when Father Amancius came from town with the disastrous news. The bloat was terrible, and I began to get worse. How could we go on living with those ruffians at large? Of course, they would want us to pay them back by making us serve them. Wouldn't it be preferable to die, than to serve them? I remember I made my confession with difficulty. When it was over, Father Amancius gave me absolution and comforted me with encouraging words. "It seems that all devils are African, spying on me all the time, and I have been obliged to suffer their presence until today." "And when did you pass over?" "In May, 1888. I experienced a strange sense of amazement. The poor slave mistress, gazing with dim eyes at the horizon, remarked, "It's possible that my nephews forgot to pay the masses, although I left it clearly specified in my will." I was about to answer her with new ideas on fraternity and faith, when Narcisa approached and said kindly, "9 Slavery was abolished in Brazil on May 13, 1888 by a law signed by Princess Isabel, acting as a substitute for her father, Emperor Pedro II, who was traveling abroad." Translator's note. "Listen, Andre, you seem to have forgotten that we are rendering assistance to patients and mentally deranged entities. What good will all this information be to you? Unbalanced people will talk incessantly and whoever listens wastes spiritual attention, and may be no more balanced than they." She said those words in such sympathetic tones that I flushed with shame and was unable to offer an apology. "Don't worry, my friend," she went on encouragingly, "let's see to the perturbed brothers." "Are you including me in their numbers?" asked the old lady, looking hurt. Narcisa, displaying her excellent expression of sympathy, Of course not, my dear, I didn't mean you. However, I think you must be tired after your long stay in the purgatorial zones. Yes, indeed I am. The newcomer agreed. You can imagine my suffering and how I was tormented by those devils. The poor thing was about to begin the whole story again, but Narcisa cut her short. Do not dwell on evil. I know all about the bitter suffering you had to endure. Now, just relax here while I see to your needs. Turning to an attendant, she said, You, Zenobio, would you please go to the women's department and ask Nagia to prepare a bed for our new sister awaiting treatment? Chapter 35, An Unexpected Meeting. We were busy putting away the patrolling equipment and seeing to the animals, when I heard a friendly voice beside me, Hello, Andre. Fancy meeting you here. What a pleasant surprise. I turned around and was surprised to recognize the Samaritan. He was a former acquaintance of ours on Earth. Yes, it was old Silvera, whom my father, the inflexible businessman, had reduced to utter ruin. I felt acutely embarrassed. I wanted to acknowledge his greeting, to respond to his friendly approach, but my memories made me speechless. In this new environment, where countenances faithfully reflect one's true feelings, pretending was out of the question. Finally, Silvera himself noticed my discomfort and came to my help, saying, I didn't know you had come here. I had no idea I'd meet you here in the Astral City. After this spontaneous kindness, I was able to shake his hand and murmur a few words of thanks. I wanted to offer an explanation for our past attitudes but couldn't find the right words. I truly wished to apologize for my father's actions, which had forced him into disastrous insolvency. Standing there, it all came back into my mind. It was like seeing a film. I could hear his wife's tearful voice, trying to explain her husband's plight. He had been ill for a long time and, to make matters worse, two of their children had also fallen sick. Their expenses had risen, and medical attention cost so much money. I remember how the poor thing wept, begging for a respite. She spoke humbly, gazing pitifully at my mother as if attempting to find some sympathy and help in another woman. I remember how earnestly my mother pleaded with my father to forget the documents he had signed, to refrain from any legal action. Father, accustomed to successful transactions on a large scale, could not understand the retailer's difficulties and was adamant. He declared that, although he was sorry about his client's bad luck and would help him in different ways, there was nothing he could do but carry out the legal proceedings. He explained that he could not think of breaking the long-established regulations of his firm. All he had to offer his wife in consolation was the thought that some of his other clients were in an even worse position. I recalled mother's helpless sympathy as Silvera's wife tearfully took her leave, and how father, indifferent to the suffering before him, scolded her severely and forbade her to interfere in business matters in the future. Thus, there was nothing left for the poor family but to face utter financial ruin. I could still see the Silvera's piano being carried away to satisfy the implacable creditor's claims. Humbled and penniless, Silvera moved with his wife and children to a small town, where they had probably led a life of hard work and poverty. I never again heard mention of the family. I was anxious to apologize, but did not know what to say. I had, at that time, encouraged father in his merciless attitude towards the Silvera and had considered mother too sentimental in her views. Being still very young, I was dominated by feelings of selfishness and vanity. Impervious to the needs and suffering of others, I was unyielding in my attitude in spite of my mother's wise exhortations. These memories flashed throughout my mind with incredible speed. In one short moment I had crossed the shadows of the past. I could hardly disguise my embarrassment. Silvera smiled, and called me back into reality. Have you already visited the old man? The question, so filled with spontaneous caring, only increased my confusion. I answered that, although anxious to do so, I had not yet had the chance. Silvera sensed my constraint and prepared to leave. He patted me affectionately on the back and went on his way. Disconcerted, I went to Narcisa and told her of our unexpected meeting and the circumstances of our parting on Earth. I anxiously awaited her advice. After listening carefully, she replied, Don't be surprised at meeting old acquaintances here. Some time ago I found myself in a similar situation. I have already had the satisfaction of meeting most of the people here whom I had offended on earth. I realize now that it's a great blessing granted us by the Lord, so that we may have new opportunities to take up friendships which have been interrupted, repairing the broken spirit links between us. Did you avail yourself of the chance offered you? What do you mean? I asked. Did you ask Silvera to forgive you? Remember, it's satisfying to be able to recognize our own faults. You have, by now, acquired enough understanding to be your own judge. You have acknowledged yourself as the offender. Don't miss the opportunity to gain a friend. Go to Silvera, my dear, and speak to him frankly. He is a busy person, and you may not get another chance soon. As I hesitated, she added, "Don't be afraid. Whenever we follow our head and heart in the practice of good, Jesus grants us the help necessary to succeed. The accomplishment of worldly actions, whatever they may be, constitutes a privilege to the soul. Keep the Master's gospel in mind and go seek the treasure of reconciliation." I no longer hesitated, but ran after Silvera, opening my heart to him and begging him to forgive both me and my father for our past errors. "You see," I explained earnestly, "we were both blind to everything but self-interest. Whenever money and vanity go together, few avoid taking the wrong path." Silvera, greatly touched, cut me short. "Listen, Andre. Is anybody exempt from fault? Do you imagine that I led a blameless life? Besides, your father was a real teacher to me. My children and I are indebted to him for his valuable lessons and individual effort. Would we have made any spiritual progress, were it not for this firm defense of his rights? Over here, we renew all our old concepts of life and realize that our supposed enemies are really our benefactors. Don't brood over these sad memories. Let's look ahead to infinite life and work with the Lord." Noticing my moist eyes, he patted me on the back in a fatherly way, and added, "Don't waste your time over this. I hope I'll soon have the pleasure of accompanying you in visiting your father." I shook his hand in silence, feeling a new joy in my soul. It seemed that a dark little corner of my heart had been suddenly flooded with a divine light. Forever. Chapter 36, A Dream. Work went on without interruption. Many sick patients needed urgent care, and other perturbed entities required devoted attention. By evening I had mastered the technique of magnetic passes, which I applied to many of the patients. Tobias returned to the chambers in the morning, and more through generosity than any merit of mine, he encouraged me through his words of praise. "Well done, Andre," he exclaimed. "I'm going to mention you specifically to Minister Genesius, so you may receive your hour bonuses in double for your first efforts." As I was about to express my thanks, I was surprised to see Laura and Liza's coming towards us. After affectionate greetings, Laura said to me with a smile, "We simply had to come to tell you personally how happy we all are. I followed you in spirit the entire night, and your first steps on the road of brotherly cooperation are a great joy to our family. I had the pleasure of giving the good news to Minister Clarence, who sends you his best wishes. We talked for a while, and they asked to hear my impressions. I was happy to oblige. Although Laura and Liza's invited me to return home with them to rest, Tobias had offered me a room in the chambers, where I could retire without delay. I felt an urgent need to sleep. Unbeknownst to me, the greatest joy of the day was still to come. Alone in the spacious and comfortable room where Narcissa had made me a bed, I offered up a prayer to the Lord of all creation, thanking him for the joy of having been useful. Then the blessed fatigue of those who have fulfilled their duties left me no time for further musings. Within a few minutes I felt a sensation of lightness throughout my body. I had the impression of being carried away in a small boat, sailing towards unknown regions. Where was I being taken? It was impossible to tell. A silent man sat beside me at the helm. I felt like a child, unable to describe the wonders before me. Ecstatic at the magnificence of the scenery, I let myself be carried along without a word. The little craft seemed to be sailing rapidly, and at the same time gradually ascending. After a short time I found myself in a marvelous harbor, and heard a voice calling me lovingly from the pier. Andre, Andre. I could tell that voice from a thousand others. Overwhelmed with joy, I disembarked with childlike zeal, and a moment later I was in my mother's arms. She led me to a beautiful forest, where flowers seemed to retain light, offering a permanent feast of perfume and color. Luminous golden carpets stretched out under the rustling foliage of the great trees. I felt an ineffable sensation of peace and happiness, different from the dream states I had experienced on Earth. I was well aware that I had left my heavier body in my room in the chambers of rectification, and was conscious of being in higher sphere. My notions of time and space were accurate, and I felt the wealth of emotions I was experiencing grow more and more intense. After inspiring me with words of appreciation, my mother explained, "I prayed fervently to Jesus that I might be granted the sublime satisfaction of your visit on your first day of useful service. As you already know, my son, work is a divine tonic for the heart. Many of our companions, on leaving the earth, linger unproductively, awaiting miracles that never occur, their fine possibilities reduced to expressions of parasitism. Some plead discouragement from loneliness, others declare themselves maladjusted to the way in which they were called to serve the Lord. It is indispensable, Andre, to convert every opportunity in life into a reason to remember and serve God. Just as in the lower spheres the bowl of soup given to the hungry, the balm offered to the leper, and the gesture of sympathy towards one stricken by adversity, are sublime deeds forever remembered in the house of the Father. Here a look of understanding cast to the sinner, the promise of the gospel brought to those in despair, and hope imparted to the afflicted are blessings of spiritual work which also weigh greatly in our favor." I had never before seen my mother's face so beautiful. Her eyes seemed to shine with a spiritual radiance and her tender hands transmitted invigorating fluids and an indescribable sensation of bliss to me. "Jesus' gospel, Andre," she continued, "teaches us that there is greater joy in giving than in receiving. For our own happiness, let's learn to put this principle into practice in our daily efforts. Always give, my child, but above all never forget to give of yourself, in constructive tolerance, brotherly love and divine understanding. External charity is only a lesson, and a means to lead us to the more difficult practice of charity from within. Jesus gave more of himself to redeem mankind than all the earth's millionaires congregated in the fulfillment of material charity, however sublime their efforts may have been. Don't be ashamed to offer aid to our sickly brothers or clear the minds of the disturbed entities that come to the chambers of rectification, where I spiritually followed your work last night. Work, my child, doing all the good you can. In all our spirit colonies, as on earth, live restless souls anxious for novelty and distraction. As often as possible, try to avoid those amusements and devote yourself to useful service. Just as I, insignificant as I am, can see in spirit your efforts in the astral city, while following your father's suffering in the lower zone, God sees and accompanies us all, from the most evolved messenger to the lowest beings in the scale of creation." My mother paused briefly, and I tried in vain to speak. Although tears of emotion had rendered me speechless, she understood my feelings. Looking at me with deep affection, she went on, "In most spirit colonies, services are remunerated with the hour bonus which unites two essential factors. The bonus represents the possibility of receiving something from our brothers and co-workers, or of recompensing someone sharing our efforts. However, the determination of the hour's value, just as on earth, belongs exclusively to God. Because of our fallibility as evolving beings, errors may occur in awarding our bonuses. The real computation of the spirit hour is a private question between the worker and the divine forces of creation. That's why our experimental activities on the road to progress, starting at the physical sphere, undergo continuous, daily modifications. The administrator to whom the Lord has granted the opportunity of cooperating in the divine plan of life, experiment with tables, registers, and remuneration. He grants them this opportunity just as he grants his creatures the temporary privilege of being fathers or mothers on earth or in other worlds, and all sincere administrators do their utmost to carry out the tasks assigned them to the best of their abilities. Every father, conscious of his responsibilities, is full of a devoted love. God also, my child is a careful administrator and most loving father. He never forgets any of his children and reserves his right to a direct understanding with his workers about real merit of the use of their time. All outward reward affects the personality undergoing the test, but the value of time concerns the eternal personality, the one that will always be present in our circles of life, on its upward march towards the glory of God. This is why the Most High gives wisdom to those who spend time learning in a longer life and greater joy to those who know how to forget themselves in serving others. Mother became silent. As I dried my eyes, she put her arms around me. Like a boy who falls asleep after a lesson, I lost consciousness of everything until I awoke in my room near the chambers of rectification with an invigorating sense of joy. Chapter 37, Veneranda's Lecture. All through my work the following day, I looked forward to Veneranda's lecture, which was scheduled to take place after the evening prayers. Knowing that I needed permission to attend, I sought out Tobias. "These talks," he said, "are only attended by truly earnest spirits. The instructors here can't afford to waste time. You may go along with the hundreds of workers and patients of the ministries of regeneration and assistance. I trust you will profit by it," he added, encouragingly. My new day was spent in intense activity. The visit to my mother and her enlightening words on the practice of good had filled my spirit with sublime contentment. At first, her explanation of the hour bonus had raised certain doubts in my mind. How could compensation be granted by God? Wasn't the reckoning of time a task of the spirit or human administrator? Tobias explained that the task of recording the period of service was generally assigned to administrators, as was that of fixing standards of wages and privileges according to a worker's merit, but only the divine forces could accurately calculate the essential value of time. There are workers who, after devoting 40 years to some activity, end up just as inefficient as they began, a sure sign that they accomplished their task without the least spiritual interest. Likewise, there are people who after 100 years of earthly life will depart just as ignorant as they arrived. To understand how precious your mother's concept is, Tobias said, it is enough to compare the hours spent by good men to those wasted by bad ones. The former become fountains of divine blessings, while the latter are instruments of torture and remorse. Each living being must settle accounts with the Father for opportunities received and work accomplished. At the hour appointed for the lecture, following the evening prayer, Narcissa, Celestius and I made our way to a large natural hall. The hall was a wonder of shades of green, and we sat on comfortable benches formed from the vegetation. Various flowers glittered under the light of the chandeliers and scented the air with ineffable perfume. I looked around curiously. I noticed 20 of them sitting decidedly apart from the crowd, between us and the flowery mound which supported the lecturer's chair. I inquired, and Narcissa explained, "We are seated with a regular audience. The brothers in the special seats are the most advanced students on the subject to be covered this evening. They are the only ones allowed to ask the instructor questions or present arguments. They have acquired this privilege through their applying themselves to that particular line of study. We may also attain such a privilege, in time. Aren't you allowed to sit with them?" I asked. "Not this evening. As yet, I may sit there only when the lecture deals with the treatment of disturbed entities. However, some may stay for lectures on more than one topic, according to the degree of the knowledge they have already acquired." "A curious procedure," I remarked. "The governor," she continued, "established the procedure in all classes and lectures in the different ministries to keep them from being converted into futile discussions of unfounded personal beliefs. Any worthy doubts or differing viewpoints may be duly considered and elucidated, but only at the proper moment." She had hardly finished speaking when Veneranda entered the hall, accompanied by 2 women of a distinguished bearing, who, Narcissa informed me, were ministers of communication. Every face lit up with joy at the sight of Veneranda, who looked nothing like the old lady her name seemed to imply. She appeared to me to be noble, simple, and unaffected. After a brief exchange of words with the brothers in the special seating, she began by saying, "As usual, our short meeting does not allow for long bursts of eloquence. I am here to talk to you about certain thought processes. Among us tonight are a few hundred listeners who are still surprised about the similarity of forms on the physical plane and in our spirit sphere. They have learned that thought is the universal language, and have been told that mental creation is the most important factor in spirit life. Numerous brothers are asking themselves questions, such as why they find earthly dwellings, utensils, and even the same forms of speech here. Yet this fact should not be a motive of surprise to anyone. We must not forget that, up to now, while in the physical body, we have lived in circles of antagonistic vibrations. Thought is the basis of all spiritual relations, but we must keep in mind that we are millions of souls in the universe still far from perfect obedience to universal laws. We cannot, as yet, be compared with our older and wiser brothers nearer to the divine spheres. We are millions of entities living in the undisciplined inferior worlds of our ego. The great instructors of physical mankind teach divine principles and expound eternal truth, but in our earthly life we generally learn these laws without obeying them. We acknowledge these truths without consecrating our lives to them. Now then, do you imagine that by just admitting the power of thought, man can be purged of his inferior condition? Certainly not, it would be impossible. 100 years on the planet represent much too short a period of training for us to become divine cooperators. During our earthly apprenticeship, we learn the principles of mental force, but forget that, for thousands of years, we have used our thought energies to form destructive mental creations, or at best creations harmful to ourselves. We follow courses of spiritualization in the various religious schools of the world, yet, with most of us, it is frequently a question of mere verbal adherence, of lip service and nothing else. No one, however, can attend to his duty through words alone. The Bible teaches us that the Lord of life himself did not stop with a word, but put his creative work into action. We all know that there was an essential force, but we overlook the fact that we have misused that force over centuries. We all know that it is man's duty to provide for his own children. Likewise, each spirit is compelled to maintain and nourish his own creations. A criminal idea will produce mental creations of the same nature. A lofty principle will observe the same laws. Let me illustrate the fact with a more objective example. After rising to great heights, water is purified and carries vigorous vital fluids, returning as the vivifying dew and generous rains. Keep it on earth, mixed with the impurities on the soil, and it will become a foul mire, a habitat for destructive microorganisms. Thought is a living force everywhere. It is the creative atmosphere involving the Father and his children, the cause and effects in the universal home. Through it men become either angels on their way to heaven or devilish fiends on the road to hell. Have you grasped the importance of this? Of course, evolved minds, both discarnate and incarnate, may communicate mentally without any need for form. Thought is, in itself, the basis of all of the mind's silent messages within the marvelous planes of intuition shared by beings of all kinds. Within this principle, a spirit who has lived only in France can communicate, mind to mind, with one in Brazil, regardless of language barriers. The language will always be that of the receiver. This, of course, depends on perfect attunement. However, we are not yet in the spheres of mental purity where all creatures are perfectly attuned to one another. Here we attune to one another in isolated groups and are compelled to carry on the transitory tasks of the planet so that we may return to it with a higher degree of efficiency. Therefore, the astral city as a transitory spirit colony is a great blessing granted us as an additional mercy in order that a few may prepare themselves to rise to higher spheres, and the majority may return to Earth on redeeming missions. I beg you, my friends, let us all realize the importance of the processes of the mind and live up to them from now on. Who is willing to try? She said as she smiled to the audience after a long pause. Soft music filled the air with melodious strains. The instructor continued to speak, radiating love, comprehension, sympathy and wisdom. Then, without any preparatory phrases or gestures, she closed her talk with a question. What? Is the lecture over already? I asked, surprised to see the audience rising to leave. That's Venerando's way. The nurse answered with a smile.